people. House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness for Wednesday, September 30th, 2015. And at the beginning, we're going to have our organizational meeting. We needed a quorum to look at the minutes. Has everyone had a chance to read those minutes?
Rules.
And rules?
There we go.
So are there any objections to the rules?
I think I have to make a motion.
Thank you. Yeah.
Chair McLean, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Okay, there has been a motion to move the committee rules. Now, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the rules have been adopted. At this time, then, we're going to go to an informational hearing on online title loans. And we have folks who have come and they've been invited speakers. And I believe our first one is David, is it Tatman?
Tatman.
Is it Tatman? Okay, thank you. We'd love to have you come up and...
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I'd like to bring up Rick Blackwell.
Absolutely.
He's our policy analyst.
Okay, thank you.
Probably great service to all of you.
So good afternoon to all of you. For the record, my name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We are a regulatory agency within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and our charge is to oversee any number of financial services. We run the gamut from banking to credit unions to mortgage lenders to stockbrokers, as well as all the many financial service providers, including consumer finance lenders, payday lenders, check cashers, and the like. So our jurisdiction has been touched on in many different areas in this area of internet lending. What I want to start with your indulgence, is a little bit of background so you have somewhat of a context. And if I get to the point where you think, well, I think I understand this, you can just tell me. Mm-hmm. Good enough. So the first thing I want to talk about is what are we talking about in terms of lending in Oregon? We're not going to be talking about depository lending, which would be banks and credit unions that separately regulate separate standards to some degree. So what I want to focus on are three types of lending. We lump those together, short-term lending, that would be consumer finance lending, payday lending, and title lending. Oregon has jurisdiction over those types of loans if they're made to somebody from Oregon, somebody in Oregon, or if they're paid out, that is repaid, through bank accounts in Oregon. So we have fairly broad jurisdiction, and we think that's a good thing. As we come to the discussion later in my presentation, you'll see that was something that was adopted a few years ago, and we've been able to use that effectively. So what is a consumer finance loan? A consumer finance loan is typically just what it sounds like. It's loans made to consumers for any number of purposes. We tend to use a definition the Department of Justice uses, and that's to say it's for personal, family, or household purposes, as opposed to a business loan, although there is some crossover in this day and age. Oftentimes, but not always, it may be somebody with subprime credit history because they're using this, but not in all cases. Many times it's used to finance a car, finance some kind of machinery, washing machine and the like, or it may be just a character loan or a HELOC, that is a home equity line of credit. And so pretty standard stuff. A lot of people use them. They've been around a long time. The loans by statute and rules are to run 60 days or longer. They could be secured or unsecured. They require the consumer, they make a determination by the lender that the consumer has the ability to repay the loan based on credit history and underwriting. And that's a distinction between payday lenders and consumer finance. And the loans are to be amortized, that is equally spread out over payment periods, and they're to be paid in periodic payments as opposed to a single lump sum payment. They have to comply with all the federal rules under Reg Z and Truth in Lending and so forth. They have contract requirements under Oregon laws that they have to adhere to, and they're subject to examinations by our office on a periodic basis to determine compliance. We have roughly 137 consumer finance lenders licensed with us, so that's a fair number, but many of them are outside the state, and that reflects the location rather than the number of companies. For the most part, they do great work. The examinations show they're in compliance most of the time. Our licensed consumer finance lenders do what they're charged with doing, and we think they're a good asset to the community. payday and title loans. A payday loan is something that's morphed over time. Payday loans have not been around that long. About 20 years ago, we started seeing them. Originally, they were supposed to be a short-term loan to tide somebody over who needed financial assistance for a short period of time until they reached payday. So the amount was supposed to be small. They weren't underwritten. They're more of a character loan. And most of the time, they were secured by a post-dated check for the amount of the money borrowed plus the interest. And the lender would receive that check, and on the day it came due, they would cash the check, and the loan would be settled. Subsequently, we've seen the process morph dramatically in terms of payday lending. More and more, we're seeing that the loan amounts have increased significantly, so they're well above historically the modest amounts that people were lending, and they relied on repayment through ACH or automatic debiting of bank accounts, where somebody would sign a contract with the lender saying they could debit their account to take out both principal and interest. That would be against the borrower's bank account. That has proven to be very problematic because once entered into, very difficult to get out of that account short of just closing the account itself, out of the ACH. What we saw was people were in situations where they're unable to make the repayments, and so the interest would be then rolled into the loan itself. The loan would be renewed for a greater amount, and over the course of time, we were watching loans increase over size to the point where after a year or so, people would be in what we called a cycle of debt. They were unable to repay these things, and so it was very problematic, and this reached a head in 2005 and 2007 when this body, the legislature, put into effect limitations on both interest rates, the number of times you could renew a loan, the amount you could charge in fees, and ensuring that the loans had a sufficient amount of time for a person to repay it, a minimum of 31 days. And so with that, we saw the model change significantly. Payday lending, again, by licensed payday lenders, proved to be somewhat that was useful in the narrow gap that was designed for. We have 63 licensed payday lenders. And again, we go out and we examine them for adherence to the contract requirements. We examine them to determine they're complying with federal laws and state laws. And as I said, for the most part, we find that their compliance is sufficient and they're meeting the expectations we have for them. The third and last version of lending is title lending. It's just what it sounds like. Somebody will loan against the title of an automobile. This is not to purchase the automobile. This is a secondary loan. Again, the idea is that person would take a short-term loan for a financial pinch that they're in and then repay that shortly thereafter. Title lending is subject to the same requirements in terms of the contract and disclosures. We also examine them. In reality, there are no licensed title lenders in Oregon. They are joint lenders who are both payday lenders and title lenders. We have 41 that hold dual licenses in that area. So what I want to talk about now, though, is the internet lending with that background. So internet lending, what I'm not talking about are the internet lenders who are licensed with us. We have 30 consumer finance licensed lenders who are internet lenders, and we have 5 payday lenders who are internet lenders that are licensed with us. But I'm talking about thousands of payday lenders who are not licensed with us, or title lenders, or both. The reality is there is no real distinction between payday, title, and consumer finance in terms of these internet unlicensed lenders. They are just lending on a basis of receiving, sending out money to somebody's account and in return receiving payments through the ACH. Now, a few of them actually have gone through the title, and we'll talk a little bit about that, as will the Department of Justice. That's the Auto Loans LLC case, where there actually were titles, which actually proved to be very beneficial for us in terms of investigating and stopping the practices. But for the most part, most of the loans we're seeing are unsecured, and they're just similar, whether they call them payday, title, or consumer finance. I'm also not prepared, or I am prepared to talk about it, but I wasn't going to include this at this point, and that's a peer-to-peer lending, which is something that you've probably heard a lot about in the media, Prosper.com, and what's the other one, Rick?
For the record, Rick Blackwell, DCBS. The other one is Lending Club.
Lending Club. So those two are very prominent in the news these days, and that's a different vehicle. I'm happy to answer questions or talk about it if you want me to, but at this point, that's a different set of circumstances with different regulatory concerns. What I want to focus on right now, though, is just the allegedly short-term consumer finance lending that we've been talking about. So what we've seen is a growing sophistication in the marketing of these loans through the Internet. As you may know, we're seeing that the volume as well as the complexity of these loans grow dramatically. The Internet is something that keeps growing rapidly, and people keep turning to it more and more. One commentator estimated that in 2010, 20% of short-term loans were done through the Internet. As of 2015, he's estimating at 60%. So we've watched a dramatic increase of Internet lending. I'm not sure what this is all about. Is it financial desperation, or is it the addictiveness of the Internet itself, or is it just the standard siren call of easy money? Whatever it is, people are turning to it at an alarming rate. With so many consumers accessible through the Internet, the marketing groups have developed a fairly sophisticated methodology for marketing these products. And they use a three-part program nowadays to try, to limit their exposure and also just to make it more complex in terms of figuring out who's really at the back end of all this. So the parties involved in a typical online transaction are threefold: an advertiser, a lead aggregator, and then, of course, the funder. The advertiser does just what it sounds like, promotes payday and consumer finance loans through various Internet marketing means, banner ads, which I'm sure you've seen, pop-up ads, which unfortunately we all are familiar with, search engine ads. So in other words, you go into the search engine and up pops an ad, first thing on top, unsolicited commercial email or spam, and social media. The loan aggregators are the most interesting party in all this, and their job is to act as a conduit between the advertiser and the ultimate lender. And what they do is they will collect loan information from the consumer and put it into a package and use that package to promote, broker, facilitate, sell, however you want to describe it, the potential loans to a multitude of different lenders. Typically a group of lenders, perhaps up to 30, may bid on a single individual consumer's application in real time. And it's done in such a way that the consumer has no idea. This is not one of those areas that you may have seen on television where they talk about someone brokering this to different lenders. This is done behind the scenes. It raises real concerns for us in terms of consumer protection and protection of personal private information, because the information they're giving up is bank information, bank account information, salary information, obviously key personal information, and that information is being distributed to a wide array of people who most of the time we don't have any knowledge about. The process itself, Rick was able to do some research and provide this for me. What they will do is collect this information and do it in such a way that it's integrated into a single style sheet. As I said, the consumer's not aware of this, and they don't realize that it isn't going to just a single lender, or in fact that the aggregator or the loan aggregator isn't the one that they're dealing with directly. And so, again, the consumer is misled and not aware of what's happening to their information. The lenders themselves are able to come up with their own formula. So they will determine what they're bidding on, and it's automatic. Again, it's all computer-generated. They'll have parameters for the type of borrower they're working for. Is a borrower over 21? How often does a borrower get paid? How many loans does the borrower have outstanding? That kind of information. So then, depending on the quality of the borrower, they will bid a certain amount. And so if they have the prevailing bid or if it meets their criteria and their bid is higher than the others, then they get the loan. The process then, if the top end one, the one that would pay the most, it doesn't meet their criteria, then it's dropped down to the next set of criteria and so forth. It's called a ping tree, and you'll hear that phrase periodically. And a ping tree, it just pings down this list of potential lenders until they get to a place where somebody settles on, yes, this is I'm willing to fund this loan. Lenders obviously do this in volume, so they're involved as many ping trees as possible. As I said, the most intriguing part of this is the lead aggregator. What we are finding is that the lead aggregator is the one that's maybe holding all the pieces together. They're the ones that have all the different connections. The lenders are, if you will, just a rotating source for funding, and they come and they go, and the names change. And oftentimes what we find is that through various different shell corporations, LLCs and alike, maybe somebody or somebody's organizations will have an interest in all of these. And it's very challenging for us to penetrate to get to the point where we can determine who's really behind setting these things up. I failed to mention one of the biggest challenges for us, and Rick, again, did we put these things into all this? Did we list the countries where people reside?
Chair McLean, we did not, but we do have a list available with us.
So we have put together a list of the different locations where these lenders reside. Surprisingly, most of them live outside, well, claim to be outside the United States, many of them in the Caribbean, so Nevis and other Caribbean locations, places down in the South Pacific, places of where there's a fairly lax rule of law, if you will, or limitations on the ability to access information, especially financial information. And it's difficult for us to get our to reach these people, get a response from these people, let alone try and get any kind of process served on them to obtain records from them and things of that. It's the real challenge trying to reach them and take enforcement action against them. So I think it's probably self-evident, but just to touch on this a little bit, the harm that comes from this type of lending is huge. Biggest harm is, of course, to consumers. People get into loans, they're unable to repay, they get under this financial burden. What we see is, as I said, the interest rate caps in Oregon are 36% or 3% a month. That's true for consumer finance, payday lending, title lending, and pawnbrokers, so all our short-term lenders. What we see is that interest rate caps, when projected over a whole year, would exceed 250% readily, and many times over 500%. So significant interest is being tacked on. More problematic is their practice of recovering their fees and the interest. These ACH agreements allow them to go into banks and take out money periodically. And what they do deliberately is just constantly take out interest without ever taking down the principal, keeping that loan open and continuing to take money out periodically, usually without any real rhyme or reason. We haven't been able to figure out the rhyme or reason, but to the point where we've seen loans for $200 to $300 with repayment amounts over $1,000, and still they're told if they can get hold of their lender that they owe an additional $300 to $400. So people are really harmed financially by that. In addition, we see harm to the legitimate businesses that I've talked about already. They're competing on an unlevel playing field while they're providing legitimate products. All too often, they're not the first place people turn to for whatever reason when they go to the internet. As I say, these pop-up ads come up first, or the consumer doesn't realize that they are protected by the Oregon law and that they're protected through limitations on interest rates and fees. We've expended a lot of time in terms of trying to educate consumers. Rick tells me that this is in OLIS. This is a pamphlet we put out for consumers. The title is, Would You Pay $1,000 for a $300 Loan? Pretty self-evident question. I think most people wouldn't understand what the answer should be. Having said that, many people do that, mostly through ignorance rather than through recognition of what they're going to be paying. 2 years ago, around the Christmas season, we put together a campaign of advertising through the radio and local transit authorities and so forth, bus ads and alike, trying to encourage people to check and find out who they're working with, try and find a licensed consumer finance lender or payday lender before they took out money for the holiday seasons.
question. Could we just...
Absolutely.
Representative Holby?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a step back for a second. So these internet lenders that you're speaking of, especially the ones that are out of state or out of country, are they required to be licensed in Oregon?
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, Representative Holby, absolutely. They're required to be licensed. And in fact, in the last 5 years, starting in 2010, we've taken approximately 50 administrative actions. That's our enforcement orders against unlicensed companies, usually based upon excessive interest and so forth, not just being unlicensed. But, yes, they are required.
And a follow-up.
Yes.
And so the most of these problems you're talking about are the unlicensed lenders as far as these activities go?
Absolutely, Madam Chair and Representative Holby. So in the last 5 years, in the area of payday and title lending, we've received 490 complaints. 463 involved unlicensed lenders.
Yes, sir.
And so, in that they're unlicensed, is the licensed people, do we require the beneficial ownership information of the licensed lenders?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, you're going to have to enlighten me. I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, you say it's hard to get to who these people really are as far as these licensed entities, the ones that are licensed. Do we require that who owns them, what their name and address is, you know, who the principals of the...
I understand now. So, Madam Chair and Representative Holby, absolutely. So anybody that owns a certain amount of interest, so I just did a consumer finance license review. We had three applicants, two owned 47.5 and one owned 5%. All of them went through a background check. All of them went through a credit history check. We have their address. We know who they are, what their experience is.
Is there an ability or is there a current law that could or does require that a bank cannot allow an ACH to an unlicensed lender to disallow that kind of transaction and make it a
Madam
to
Chair,
disallow a
Representative Holby, let me take the back door on that. So
great, any door you can find.
A contract, the bank would probably honor it, but the question would be, are they facilitating illegal conduct? What this body just passed in 2015 was essentially a restriction on collections and efforts to enforce illegal payday loans. So if a consumer is in that situation where the consumer has obtained a loan illegally or has obtained a loan that is illegal, and the ACH problem is ongoing, it's my belief they can go down to the bank and have that conversation and show this is an illegal loan. And I think the bank has some responsibility to respond to that. The challenge is the ACH is a contract between the individual consumer and the individual lender. The bank's not there to decide was that a valid contract or it isn't a valid contract. I think the bank's in an untenable position. We hope that this new law will give some additional ability for consumers to address that. What it was really designed to address, though, was the collection efforts where people are collecting, where something's turned over to a collection agency, and the collection agency does have a duty to make sure it's a valid contract. And so that's where it would work.
I guess where I was, I guess where I was trying to articulate not very well was since this is a contract between this unlicensed lender and the consumer, and they have an agreement, ACH agreement, there isn't the ability for the bank account that is where the money's coming out of to say, well, this isn't a licensed lender, therefore we cannot honor this ACH agreement.
Madam Chair, Representative Holy, I fully understand your question. I think this is a very challenging area. You're asking banks to act as police, and I don't know that banks, A, want that authority or responsibility, and B, as you may have heard, there was an unfortunately named Operation Choke Point that went down a few years ago, and Congress was very upset because it had the impact of putting the banks in that untenable position. I think the banks are very leery of being put in that role. With this new law, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But the law was designed to give consumers some vehicle of redress if they find themselves being victimized by the loan they took out.
Representative Stark, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair McLean. If you'll bear with me, I want to recap, because I've seen, I think you've identified four problems that you're trying to make us aware of. So I want to see if I got this right on the right spectrum. One of the problems you're saying that there is that borrowers are unaware that their information is going to various people when they put in this application online, and that it's being bid on behind the scene, and so you're worried about security, about where, who gets what information, when that may not be the final person offering the loan. Then you talked about, and that I see that, I don't know that we have current laws, someone could enlighten me on to deal with that. And then you talked about that we're exceeding these loans, oftentimes exceed interest caps that we already have in place. So that problem is already, it's people are breaking the law that we have. Then you identified that there are illegitimate products in a legitimate field. But again, that's people breaking the law that we already have. And then the issue that you guys were just discussing, the inability to stop an ARCH payment or an ACH payment. I'm confused, and again, this is a new field for me. I'm confused by that if someone can't do that. Now, I can call up the bank on a regular check that I've written and say, please stop payment on check number 1023. And they'll do that. So why would I not be able to call up the bank and say, please stop ARCH payments from XYZ vendor?
Madam Chair and Representative Stark, we did some research into this, and we found essentially some language in the federal law that attempted to address that. Give me a moment. I'll see if I can put my hands on it.
Chair McLean, Representative Stark, if I may. So Regulation E basically says that in a pre-authorized ACH transaction where someone, a consumer, has given someone advance authorization to debit the account, the consumer can cancel that within 3 business days, but they need to know that ACH is going to go through 3 days before. Some of the problems with the collection efforts are that they actually come at different times as well. And so it may be difficult for them to exercise their rights under the EFTA if the lender is collecting at different times.
So may I do a
follow-up?
Thank you, Chair McLean. So just to be clear, right now, are you just trying to highlight some challenges we're having, or are you actually recommending a course of action? Do you have? I'm assuming you have things in mind on how you're hoping some of these are resolved.
Representative McLean and Representative Stark, I think this is a broader discussion. We clearly need to have the banks here and have that conversation with them. So I'm not here to recommend we do that. If that's feasible, that may be the right course of action to take. But there is something to say, and I know this will be what you're going to hear, is there something to be said in terms of honoring contracts that are entered into. And the problem is many times for the consumer, as Mr. Blackwell said, they're not aware there's a problem until they're months down the road or even a year down the road. So at what point do they come in and try and address that? It may be that the banks are being abundantly cautious or overly cautious in taking the step of dishonoring or disallowing the ACH payment out of fear of repercussions on the party to receive the payment. So I'm going to defer to the banks on that, or I'd be happy to see if we could bring that up at a later time. But I'm not making that recommendation right now.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes. Thank you.
I apologize for all the questions. Thank you. Did you just say we're concerned that a consumer might have money taken out of their account for an entire year before they ever realize they have money taken out of their account?
I wasn't saying what I think you just said. I wasn't saying that. I wasn't trying to say that. What I was saying was a consumer may not be aware there's a problem for up to a year because things are being taken out as they thought, but then they continue to take it out, and all of a sudden, they, on a $300 loan, they may have had $1,500 taken out, and that's when they become aware that, wait a minute, this is fraudulent, a scam, illegal.
Representative Hoyle.
Thank you very much. And I guess it's a comment, then a question. I think Representative Stark outlined sort of four issues that you highlighted, but there is a fifth that really goes to where some of the greatest problem is, which is that the payments are being put towards interest and not towards the initial loan. And so where someone might be having money taken out and expect that they're paying this off with an appropriate interest rate, the money is only going to interest, so they're never, ever, ever paying off the loan at all. And is there something that we can do about that, saying that if someone makes a payment, that it can't 100% can't go to interest for a certain period of time? Or because really, if you think that you're paying something off and, oh, it's going to take me a year, and yes, you have a high interest rate because either you don't have collateral, or you know, you have bad credit, or whatever it is, or you're not financially literate. I mean, a lot of the people in my district are just not financially literate. But you think you're paying it off, you're having money taken out, it's being taken out at different times, so it's, you know, difficult. But what can we do about that so that we can assure that some of that money is going towards that base loan?
Chair McClain and Representative Hoyle, that is the biggest problem of all.
Right.
This is a problem that is confounding the CFPB, the FTC, the Department of Justice. I'm not sure that the state of Oregon is going to come up with a separate answer. I will tell you, we need to step back and realize we're dealing with crooks. We're not dealing with legitimate businesses. This is a model that is used to separate people from their money. The legitimate ones, as I said, they'll structure it in such a way that their payments are either amortized and they're paying down their principal as well as paying the interest on a periodic payment plan, or if it's a single one-time payment, then it's all taken out at once. The ones that aren't legit probably aren't going to do anything to adhere to that. They'll take as much money as they can get, and then when somebody puts a kibosh on it, many of them walk away. Not all. We can talk a little bit about the auto loan case in a minute, but not all of them walk away, but most of them will walk away and say, you know, it's all profit to the good. And so I'm not sure there's a good answer. I think, again, maybe I'm mishearing this, but what I think is being presented is possibly trying to put the banks in the position of being monitors, and I think that would be a real challenge for the banks.
Yes, please.
Sorry, just follow up. I think you're right. You've identified what the real problem is, and it's not the majority of people who are operating in good faith, but these people who are not following the laws that we have and are taking advantage of people in a vulnerable position. I don't think having the banks being in the position of overseeing what's a good and bad loan is necessarily appropriate, but they do need to be involved. I think potentially having provisions that if you do business with people in the state of Oregon and you're operating in this way, that you can cancel that kind of a contract. I mean, if there's some kind of rules we can put on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, you know, we don't want people to be able to not adhere to a contract or pay back a loan that they took out just because they don't want to pay it. On the other hand, if you have this business that's not operating in good faith, then clearly there should be a way to get out of that contract and not have that money taken out. But, you know, I think we would have to set up a process for that.
Madam Chair and Representative Hoyle, that's steps A and B. Step A has been achieved already. This body this year passed Senate Bill 278, and that basically says if it's an illegal contract, in other words, an unlicensed payday loan, then the loan could be treated as void and uncollectible. So that already exists. It's brand new. It just takes effect, I believe, this month?
Last week, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Chair McClain, last week.
So it's brand spanking new. We don't know what the consequences will be, but that's a real good start. Now the question is, how do we take that and put it into effect with our financial partners? And that's partly is going to be educational. A big part of the education is for the consumers to understand that they have certain remedies. And then the big issue is that we hope will encourage people to go use licensed people where this is not a problem. If you're licensed and you mm-hmm. adhere to the law, then there's no voiding or it's all collectible.
And then just one quick follow-up. And then the third part of that is having a kind of penalty, although it's hard to find these people to give them the penalty, but to have the kind of penalty that makes it not in their financial interest to operate in that manner.
And if I could respond, then, Madam Chair, Representative Hoyle and Representative Stark, that is where I wanted to go with the conclusion of this. We have to find a way to make this untenable, unpalatable for them to do business. Very hard to do, but we are looking for any kinds of suggestions. So, for instance, to cut right to the chase, one of the biggest challenges is trying to get hold of somebody to take the service. If we sue somebody administratively, there's certain criteria, and those are appropriate criteria. I firmly believe in due process, and I want people to be served. I want them to be notified. But when we have people that deal strictly through the Internet and they deal with their clientele through the Internet, we want to be able to reach out to them. At least my recommendation is use the Internet to be able to serve them and come and put them on notice that they have to respond to the state of Oregon via that. Now, we have to be careful. Obviously, the Internet's not an airtight method of knowing who's behind the scenes, but we would like to see if we could do something with the Department of Justice to come up with some form of service that would allow us to reach through and reach these people. Second of all, we really need to work on trying to find ways to impose these financial penalties. We can impose penalties till the cows come home. We've got penalties against people ranging from $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, up to $30,000, $40,000. If we collected them, they might stop. And in fact, when we do get hold of somebody and they do have a reason to respond, it's amazing how fast they're willing to repay people that have been harmed because it's in their financial interest. But these companies that operate it with impunity that are allegedly in Nevis or St. Kitts or the Isle of Man or whatever location they happen to be in for that week, it's much harder to get them to stop. At best, maybe they'll change their name and go on about their business. Going back to Representative Holby's initial question about the beneficial interests, the beneficial owners, that's the big challenge. How many layers do we have to penetrate to find out who's really behind this? Mm-hmm. And when we do, we're able to take some action. There's a pretty infamous case involving a person who was involved in payday lending on the Internet. Turned out he claimed he had tribal sovereign immunity. Well, once we were able to identify who he was and we went to the tribe, talked to the tribe said, no, we didn't authorize him to work on behalf of the tribe. It turned out he was a part, I don't know how you describe this, but I guess he had sufficient heritage to connect him with the tribe to some degree, but he's totally unaffiliated with it. And so we were able to penetrate through that and finally get to him and then stop his practices. But it is a big undertaking to get through that. And if you multiply that by the hundreds of complaints we get, we've got to pick and choose. And it's very hard to tell on the surface what's a good case and what isn't.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chairman. So Rep. Hoyle, on the fifth point she added there on the financial literacy and really truth in lending on interest-only type payments, the last half a dozen years, there's been a lot of, reform across the board as far as truth in lending mm-hmm. on mortgage loans and even your credit card statement. If you pay the minimum, then it's going to take you this number of years. Mm-hmm. If you want to pay it off in 3 years. How that type of disclosure that we're seeing in other arenas, what disclosure is currently required for online lending and title loans and this sort of thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark. So again, for those that are licensed, they're required to do that. And so you will see a disclosure like that, and it'll show what your total interest will be and what your total payment will be when you're all said and done, as well as the principal that you're taking out. So Reg Z or Truth in Lending is adhered to. Again, going back to my earlier comment, we're dealing with people that aren't interested in pursuing this as a legitimate business model. They're just putting money in somebody's account with the understanding they will plunder that account until you close that account. And I don't think if they wanted to do it legitimately, then I'd feel differently about that. In fact, at one point we had a law that said, if you will come in and get licensed once it comes to our attention, then the loans are within compliance with our law. Therefore, they meet the interest rates that we set in Oregon, and they have the various disclosures, and the fees aren't excessive and so forth, then we would allow them to get licensed and, if you will, retroactively clean those loans up. but in this day and age, there's no interest in that. And so I know that's a negative statement, and we're all looking for positive outcomes. We've been chasing these folks for years, and as I said, even the feds are struggling to figure out how to get through this. And then we haven't really talked about this, but then we have this overlay of sovereign lenders being essentially tribal lenders, which are very challenging for the states. And so I think that's a congressional issue. We've talked to Senator Merkley about that, and so I think that has to be addressed there. But there's a myriad of places where consumers are vulnerable. I think, Representative Stark, getting back to your original point, education is the key. And one brochure, even if we gave it to everybody, isn't going to get through to them. So we're always looking for ways to partner with people to help educate them. And in fact, we have two people dedicated outreach just going out to educate people on this and many other topics. But we certainly are looking for any suggestions in ways to help educate people.
Okay. We kind of interrupted your flow.
My flow.
I started it.
What little flow there was to it, yes. Okay. Well, let me just touch on the things that I think I've said already. So this body has done a number of things to try and change some of the problems we've had and try and make things a little more even, if you will, for the consumer. And so the 36% interest rate caps were adopted piecemeal, one for payday lenders, another for consumer finance lenders, and another for title lenders. But the sum and substance of it is all short-term lenders, including pawn brokers, have to adhere to that are licensed with us. We also expanded our jurisdiction to say all loans made in Oregon are going to be treated as Oregon loans. They have to comply with Oregon law. Mm-hmm. That didn't used to be the case. The jurisdiction where the loan was made or originated got to set the terms. Well, 50 states, 50 different responses to that. And so we think this is a far better practice. And in fact, we've had little problem with people that are licensed in other states violating Oregon law. And then we just had a brief conversation about Senate Bill 278, brand new. We're not sure how that will roll out, but it's designed to give consumers one more vehicle to help protect them when it turns out they've engaged with somebody that's unscrupulous. We wanted to highlight two cases. In the interest of your time, I'll try and speed this up a little. So you've got the Department of Justice. I'm not sure how much they want to get into the details of the Auto Loan LLC case, but I know Assistant Attorney General Eva Novick's here to talk about it a little bit. I just wanted to highlight this is a big case and a complex case, and this is the type of challenge we face. This is a case where we were able to determine from complaints that came into us in the Department of Justice that people were going in and getting, in this case, actually, internet title loans. They were actually having their titles taken possession by the lender on the vehicle, and in fact the lenders were putting their name on the titles so that they could claim ownership of these vehicles at the time of default. Because of that, our office was able to investigate, and they determined that there were over 250 Oregonians affected by this. So 250 Oregonians had taken out title loans on their vehicles through this entity. Much as I said earlier, though, it was very hard for us at first to determine who the entity was. They started out with the name Car Loans LLC, then they had an intermediary name. Turned out the real name and interest was Auto Loans LLC, and they started out affiliated with a tribe. Essentially, eventually the tribe cut ties with this association, ended that association. They then moved off to the Cook Islands, where they decided they would be their jurisdiction would be incorporated there. Mailings would be from all over the United States. If you can parse all this aside, and this takes a lot of work, we were able to determine they actually had two U.S. locations, one in Florida and one in Indiana. Hence, they were able to serve people. They were able to get a jurisdiction or authority over them. The investigation at DOJ determined that the lender made over $1 million off of just the Oregon aspect itself. And, of course, this is a national organization. That's a lot of money, and that buys a lot of legal representation, and that certainly encourages people to keep going and fight through this. This is the rare instance where there was an actual lawsuit filed. It's very expensive to file lawsuits. It's very time-consuming. We can't possibly do this over 100 complaints, and so the challenge for us is how do we stop this short of filing and making a legal case out of every one of these? And that the auto loans one was unique enough because we had so many Oregonians hurt by it and so much money. So that was the exception, not the rule. And I think that has to be kept in mind. We just can't do that in every case. I'll conclude with what I said. Concerns about being able to reach out and touch companies, put service and process on them, stop them, enjoin them by administrative order, fine them, collect the fine. It's really going to take a collective effort. That's where the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, have an advantage. They're all throughout the United States, so they touch all 50 states. Our challenge is, and again, Ms. Novick can talk to this, if we take a judgment here in Oregon, that judgment doesn't necessarily become perfected as a court judgment, and then even if it is in Oregon, then we have to somehow put it into effect or enforce it in the other state, and that takes time, money, and so forth, and without knowing if there's any money involved, that's chasing a wild goose at best. So there are a lot of limitations on what we can do, but I want to close by telling you that we're dedicated to what we do. As I said, we've taken 50 orders against these companies in the last 5 years. Our staff's committed to trying to get money back where we can. They work very hard at this, and I think we've made a dent in this, but at this point, I don't think it's going away until there's a bigger restriction put on them than at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think we've asked most of the questions, but we have one more. Yeah. Representative Holby.
Thank you. Not to drag up old topics, but, I've followed, some of these lines of thinking, trying to figure out, how to incrementally stop some of this activity, and I know you're familiar with the beneficial ownership of business entities and how that information is of who own and who's behind these companies and corporations is not something that's required. And though it has been taken up from time to time by NACUSL, at the federal level, that has always fallen flat and never has moved forward. And so I don't know if the state of Oregon has any way to help influence the CFPB or, the entities in Washington, D.C. to, try to make sure that any business entity has beneficial ownership information recorded somewhere so we know who these shell corporations really are and where, and require them to actually have a place and a person, not just an agent that seems to be protecting whoever's behind the curtain.
Madam Chair and Representative Holby, that information is always beneficial, just like it's beneficial to know who actually takes out a internet address or who owns a mail drop box or something like that. And some of that information is very hard to come by. As you know, there is no federal corporation requirement, so it would be hard to get a uniform one across the feds unless NACUSL, the Commission on Uniform State Laws, was to be adopted in all 50 states. But the bigger challenge, I think, still is for some of these entities is that they're not incorporated in the United States at all. They're offshore, and they only have to adhere to whatever standards Nevis and Kitts or Antigua or Isle of Man requires as opposed to here. In Oregon alone, as I said, if they're licensed with us, we get that information, and that may be the case in other states. But I think, again, we're dealing with companies that have no interest in really complying with the law. And so, not to parrot other areas, but a lot of times people that want to obey the law are going to obey the law, but the people that don't have any interest in obeying the law aren't going to be impacted by these requirements.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate all of the conversation and all the information, and it looks like there's a lot of issues here that we can certainly go back and look at again at the will of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our next invited testimony, I believe, is Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, and that would be Ms. Novick.
Thank you. Chair McLean and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eva Novick. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Consumer Protection Financial Fraud section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm going to give a little background on title loans, specifically apart from the online lending, and then talk a little bit about a case that the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Oregon Department of Justice have been working on together. So title loans are short-term loans that are secured by the title to a motor vehicle. In other words, the lender becomes a security interest holder on the consumer's title. In less formal terms, this means that the title loan is protected or backed up by the title to the vehicle. When a title loan is made, the consumer hands over the title to a paid-off vehicle to the lender. The consumer is still the owner of the vehicle and gets to drive the vehicle during the loan term. When the consumer pays off the loan, the lender returns the title to the consumer. But if the consumer does not pay off the loan, the lender keeps the title. So if a consumer does not pay on a title loan, the lender can repossess the vehicle and then sell it to collect on the loan, in addition to using any normal debt collection processes to collect any money that may still be owed after the sale of the vehicle. Because there is the likelihood that a consumer can lose his or her vehicle, and in most parts of the country, this also means that the consumer is losing transportation to get to work, to school, to home, title loans are banned in about half of the states in the United States. Oregon permits title loans, but in the 2009 legislative session, interest rates on payday loans were capped at 36%, and at the same time, those same caps were applied to title loans. In many states that permit title loans, there are no caps on interest rates. So in other states that permit title loans and have no caps, consumers will oftentimes pay interest rates in the triple digits. So if a consumer takes out a $1,000 loan, that loan will end up being paid back when the consumer pays, let's say, $3,500 or $4,000. Title loans are similar to payday loans in that they are short-term loans that are often rolled over into new loans when the consumer who took out the loan couldn't pay it on time. But unlike title loans, payday loans are not secured by any property, which means that if a consumer does not pay on a payday loan, the lender needs to try to collect the loan only through normal debt collection processes. Title loans are also not the same as pawn loans. Under a pawn arrangement, the consumer sells the pawned item in exchange for money. The consumer pays back the pawn loan in order to redeem the pawned item. In some states that ban title loans, lenders provide a similar product that they call a pawn loan. But in Oregon, a motor vehicle cannot be used as a pawn loan. Going back to the collections aspect of title loans, if the consumer does not pay back a title loan, the lender can sell the vehicle to cover the cost of the loan. The consumer is supposed to get the proceeds after the loan has been paid. However, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes the various fees and charges are so high that the consumer ends up owing money after the sale of the vehicle, even though the original loan was a fraction of the value of the vehicle that was securing the loan. The worst of the lenders, frequently those that are operating online only, systematically disregard a borrower's ability to repay the loan because repossession is equally or more profitable depending on the value of the vehicle that is securing the title loan. The Oregon Department of Justice received 2 consumer contacts in 2014 about title loans and 23 consumer contacts in 2005 about title loans. We received more complaints about title loans prior to 2010 when the rate caps went into effect. Almost all of our recent complaints are about a company called Liquidation LLC. So the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Oregon Department of Justice are working cooperatively to investigate and take enforcement action against this company. The company uses various different names, including Auto Loans LLC, Vehicle Liquidation LLC, Title Loan America, Sovereign Lending Solutions, Car Loan LLC, Loan Servicing Solutions LLC, Liquidation LLC, RS Financial Services, Management Solutions LLC, Buy Rent Sell LLC, and Southeast Financial Management LLC. DOJ filed a complaint on August 18, 2015, alleging violations of the laws that DCBS enforces and the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which the Attorney General enforces. In the complaint, the two agencies on behalf of the state allege the following. Liquidation LLC made more than 251 high-interest loans to Oregon consumers since 2014. The loans carried an average APR of 243%. Liquidation LLC is not licensed or registered to offer title loans, pawn loans, or consumer finance loans in Oregon. The company is allegedly organized in the Cook Islands and claims to operate in the United States from a virtual office space in Indiana. It also uses addresses in Nevada, rented by a mail scanning and forwarding company. Liquidation LLC claimed to be making pawn loans or pledge loans. The fees charged by Liquidation LLC exceeded the permissible amount that lenders can charge for both pawn loans and title loans. Knowing title loans in Oregon are legal, consumers searched online for title loans and were connected to Liquidation LLC through online lender matching services. The loans Oregon consumers took out from Liquidation LLC have principal balances of $1,000 to $5,000. Liquidation LLC did not disclose to consumers the nature of the loan, the length of time for which consumers were expected to pay the loans, the interest rates associated with the loans, or that there was a balloon payment at the end of the loan term that oftentimes exceeded the amount the consumer initially borrowed. Liquidation LLC would take the Oregon title that lists it as a security interest holder and get a new title in Indiana listing itself as the owner. After a consumer missed a payment or paid late, Liquidation LLC would repossess the vehicle and sell it at auction. So some consumers were still paying off a loan for a vehicle that they no longer had possession of or owned. At the same time DOJ filed the complaint, we also obtained an order for provisional process and froze over $320,000 in Liquidation LLC bank accounts that Oregon consumers deposited money into when they made their loan payments. We estimate that Oregon consumers have lost more than $1 million to Liquidation LLC. We are also trying to get Liquidation LLC removed from titles and get clean titles returned to consumers. Liquidation LLC has not answered the complaint. Instead, Liquidation LLC has been aggressively calling and harassing Oregon consumers to continue paying on these loans. As with other online loans, it is difficult for consumers to obtain information about who they are dealing with when they take out title loans. Tracking down the providers of online loans can also be tricky for law enforcement agencies, as you might gather by the various locations and the various names that are used just by this one company. Similar to other types of short-term loan products, there are some people that believe they fill an important niche for consumers who cannot obtain traditional loans. Other people believe that they take advantage of primarily low-income consumers. And I'm not making any policy statements as to which those are, but I did want to at least make you aware of this one case that we are working on and give you a little bit of information about how title loans work. Are there any questions?
Any questions from the committee? Yes.
Sure, I might as well try one. So law enforcement, do they have the ability to pierce the, I guess, corporate veil of shell companies to find out actually who, what people are involved in all of these different LLCs and so that you can do enforcement when you actually find them?
Representative Klain, Chair McLean, Representative Holtby. So piercing the veil is slightly different than locating these individuals. It is oftentimes very difficult to piece together who is actually behind these companies and to find a physical location in order to serve individuals. Piercing the veil, once we know who they are, if we can show that they are integrally involved in the kind of day-to-day management of the company, or that they know what's going on, that they know it's a scam, then we can get them individually tied. So we would sue them on an individual basis through piercing a corporate veil or another theory. Or if we were settling, we would make sure to include the individuals in a settlement, saying, in the future, you have to comply with our laws.
Any follow-up questions?
Yes. Please. It seems like you'd be able to track the money to a bank account somewhere, and that somehow there would be a person had to open that bank account. Do the financial regulations allow law enforcement to find these individuals in that way? Obvious, when they're out of country, it becomes difficult.
Chair McLean, Representative Holvey. So, yes, there are some laws that allow us to get some information. However, we either need to get the permission of the account holder in order to get information, which, if you're talking about a scam, it's very unlikely that that person will give us voluntarily that information, or we can get a court order, and then we can go that way to get information. So that's partially what we've done with the bank accounts that we were able to freeze, is by looking at various consumer complaints, we were able to track down the accounts that these consumers were depositing money into, and then we were able to get information about those specific accounts. But there are most likely a lot of other accounts that are out there that we don't know about. So there are limitations on what we are able to obtain.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for the information. Thank you for appearing in front of us today. And even though there's only three or four of us left, it's such important information, and it sounds like really important work to continue working on and bringing back some type of ideas that maybe you have on how we can solve some of this.
Okay, so, thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'm going to close the informational hearing on our first topic on online title loans, and we're going to our last item, and I will open.
No, that's already been done.
Oh, it's right here. I'm going to open our informational hearing, and this will be on consumer privacy update. And thank you for coming. This is Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, and this is Ms. Cheryl, is it Heimstra?
Heimstra,
thank you.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heimstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'll do my best to kind of keep things concise today. So one of the priorities of the Attorney General is consumer privacy. The reason for this is there's just so much data out there that's being collected on us. Courtesy of Intel, they predict just a huge growth in the data that's going to be collected in the next 10 years. This is largely due to IoT, which is the Internet of Things. So this is your car is connected to the Internet, your HVAC system's connected to the Internet, your toaster's connected to the Internet. It's just going to explode in the next 10 years.
Toaster?
It's out there.
Really? Okay.
So some might say, with all this information out there, is privacy dead? I mean, can we really expect any privacy anymore? And some people have just given up. But I think it's probably more like this. We want things for free. We want it now. But we're also starting to realize out there that there is so much information being collected on me. Privacy is starting to matter a little bit more. So there's this kind of give and take out there right now. And there's a lot of great things that this is called big data, all this data out there. There's a lot of great things that big data can bring. It's helped with disease control. It's helped in agriculture. It's helped in elections, all kinds of wonderful things. But with that many that much data out there, there's also potential for abuse. So we've been kind of taking a look at it. How this actually works in the real world, I'm just going to play a very short video to kind of give you an idea of what's going on.
Every Friday after work, John goes to the corner to get two slices of his favorite kind of pizza, pepper and onion. Since he's in there so much, by the time John gets there, the slices are already in the oven heating up for him. John really likes being a regular. One day, John decides to try a different spot to eat. When he walks in, he sees something familiar. Two slices of pepper and onion pizza. This is strange, because John never told this shop owner what he liked. When John asks how he knew what kind of pizza he liked, the pizza guy tells him he received it from the Pizza Preference Partnership, which is tracking everything pizza-related that John does, packaging this information, and then trading it a million times a day with other people's information. The invisible internet works the same way. Everything you click on, hover over, buy, sell, or view is being tracked by thousands of companies. Ghostery shows you every company that's tracking you when you visit a web.
So that gives you an idea of how this works. Ghostery is an interesting product. Feel free to check it out. Basically, it tracks the trackers for you so you can see who's tracking you. So kind of interesting. So that's the basic idea of how it works. And that's why there is so much data out there, is every move we make is sort of getting tracked, especially when you're online, right? So what's being done about this? The Attorney General had a privacy symposium about a year ago, and one of the themes from that symposium that kept coming up was technology is very fast, and the law is very slow. And the law is slow for many good and constitutional reasons, but what we have in the privacy realm is this, which is just kind of a patchwork of all these different laws, which means there's some areas that are covered very well, and then there's some that are not covered at all. And it creates kind of a confusing framework, as you might guess from that. So what have we done at the Attorney General's office? We took a look at these laws. We looked for patterns of coverage and patterns where there might be some areas to improve. So this last legislative session, one of the things that keeps coming up is you can't have privacy without security. So that's a good baseline to start with. We updated the Oregon Identity Theft Prevention Act, which was passed originally in 2007. This is our data breach law. You may have heard of the Target data breach, Home Depot, Primera. They're just all too common these days. So what we did was we updated the jurisdiction there. So the Attorney General is a part of the National Association of Attorneys General, and yes, they are called NAG. They have a working group that deals with data breaches. So instead of Target dealing with 50 different state actions, they can deal with this one group and work out the resolution that way. So we updated jurisdiction. We updated personal information. So much has changed even since 2007. So we've updated personal information to include medical, health insurance information, and biometrics. So if those pieces of information are breached, now Oregonians will get a notice saying this information has been breached. Also, notice will go to the Attorney General. We had a number of consumers calling into our consumer hotline, say after the Target data breach. Hey, I received this letter in the mail from, I think it's Target, and they wanted me to sign up for free credit monitoring. Is this a real thing or is this a scam? Because unfortunately, a lot of scammers take advantage after these data breaches and kind of compound the problem. You know, they call up saying, hey, I'm from Primera. We'd like to offer you free credit monitoring. What's all your personal information? And then it just keeps on cycling. So we've been having consumers call in and saying, is this real or not? And we didn't really have a way to know. Mm-hmm. So Senate Bill 601 requires notice to the Attorney General as well. I actually worked with industry a lot on this bill to find a good compromise there. We also passed a bill about phishing. This isn't the fun kind of phishing. This is scammers basically sending emails, posing as somebody else, trying to get your personal information. Apparently, I didn't put my stat in there that I was going to put in. But in 2014, there were $4.5 billion worth of losses due to phishing. So it's an older problem, but it's still definitely a relevant problem. For every phishing attack, it's about $8,500 worth of damage that can happen. So That was this year as well. And then finally, we had the Oregon Student Information Protection Act, which Chair McLean was on the Education Committee and got to see that unravel and come to pass. But basically, again, we looked at all the laws and saw, you know, is there an area where we can be effective and do some good? And the laws for student privacy were based in the 1970s. There was a lot that needed to be updated there. So this was based off of a California law, which basically said, all right, educational technology companies, you're doing great things with helping students, but we don't want you selling that information you collect on students. And we want it to be secure, because, again, no privacy without security. So they must maintain reasonable security measures. Exceptions to make these products work right and for research purposes and so forth. So, again, very very brief overview. Happy to dive into any particular area if you'd like. And there's more resources if you're extra curious. So.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair McLean. So as far as the Student Privacy Act, I know many sessions back we've also explored the ability for consumers to prevent the selling of their information that's acquired through commercial enterprise. And of course that seems to be widely opposed by almost all industries because they actually do collect this information and sell it. And are there any states that have been successful at pursuing that kind of avenue and just requiring that instead of a that commercial enterprises can just take that your personal information and acquire it and accumulate it and sell it, that they have to get permission from the consumer to actually do that?
Chair McLean, Representative Holvey, kind of, yes. So California in 2003 passed a law that said if you're going to be doing that, you need to have a privacy policy posted. And so how this has trickled down is every website now has that privacy policy button on the bottom. And we all click through it on our way through to get the free app that we want. And we buried in the language is, you know, you hand over any right to the information you are submitting when you're using this application or on our website, and we can sell and do whatever we want with that information. So that was an attempt. And it did lead to some privacy policies, which was good. A little more transparency has been out there from that California bill. But a successful update to that, I've been watching and haven't seen anything yet. So,
thank you.
Two of the other things that I remember back from the Education Committee was that, you know, part of this privacy issue is that they're always trying to use what they call suggestion engines. And especially with the student privacy, if you're a teacher in a classroom and you've got other people suggesting to kids what they're going to, what they're studying, what they're reading, when you've got them in there working on something different, that has caused some issues. And our legislation helped cover that, didn't it?
Chair McLean, it did. And actually, right now at the federal level, they are looking at modeling on the California bill, and that is a large argument going on right now in Congress.
And part of that issue is that as a teacher and as a parent, listening to that conversation in the Education Committee, I didn't want in my classroom to have students say, yes, you can send me, you know, these ideas, if I was going to be responsible for the classroom and for that student during that time, and it was happening on a school computer, and it was a student under 18 who was actually giving permission. So sometimes I think there's, again, the age difference, and there's a circumstance on where the computer is and where it's being used and where they're giving permission, because there were big concerns from some of the superintendents and folks from the schools about who was responsible and who would be sued if someone signed up for something or suggested that they were giving permission for something that might not be kosher with their family or might not be kosher later on because some information was shared that they didn't want shared. So I just think that there's a big issue, but the biggest, most important item to me as you're telling this story in these two different committees is the fact that technology is moving so rapidly that unless folks who are trying to be protectors of information or protectors of consumers or protectors of students can keep up with the technology, that we're going to continuously not know what is being shared and what is being sold. And that is a responsibility of people who are put into roles that are supposed to be protecting either citizens, students, or ourselves. And so I think it's good work and it's important work, and that it's really something that state legislators and others at the federal level really need to keep on top of. So I guess that was an editorial from the middle chair. So are there any other questions or comments that we'd like to put out here for our speaker as she comes to bring us information? Okay. Well, I want to thank you for being with us here today, and I really appreciate it. And to me, this is one of those items that we've got to keep on the agendas and keep working on.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. At this time, then, I'm going to close the informational hearing on consumer privacy and ask the committee if there's anything else, those of us that are left here, if there's anything else we'd like to talk about today. All right. Well, thank you, and we will adjourn the meeting for the day. Offer consumer protection. Adjourn the meeting for the day. Offer consumer protection.